Hello and welcome to another edition of Inquisitive Minds on Brock Radio's EFPU FM. My name is Mike Saunders, and each week at this time we explore some of the fascinating research being done by Brock University faculty and students, as well as address relevant issues that could impact the Brock community. On today's show, we talked to a Brock professor of epidemiology who recently won an award from the Ontario Confederation of Faculty Associations for his work with students. And towards the end of the hour, we'll talk to the communications manager for the OCUFA about their new campaign to help raise awareness of the incredible things that happen when research and teaching connect. In between, a conversation with a Brock Associate Professor of English Language and Literature who recently published his third book of poetry and was shortlisted by the Governor General Literary Awards. Steadfastly refusing to do the remainder of the show in iambic pentameter, Inquisitive Minds is on the air. We talk a great deal about research on Inquisitive Minds, but we also have to remember it is people doing that research. And one of those people doing some amazing research at Brock joined me in the CFBU studios last week, but we ended up not talking about research. Last fall, the OCUFA, the Ontario Confederation of Faculty Associations, recognized Dr. Brent Fott for his teaching style and work with students. Dr. Fott, a professor of epidemiology at Brock and chair of the Department of Health Sciences, says he simply wants learning to be fun and fulfilling for his students. And what more could you ask of a university professor? So when we sat down to talk last week, I decided to postpone the research conversation for another day, and this time concentrate on the man behind the award and the research, a man devoted to his profession, his students, and the pursuit of knowledge. I asked Dr. Fott if it seems like over 20 years since he began teaching at Brock.
It doesn't seem that long. No, it doesn't.
Did you ever imagine 22 years later you would still be at Brock?
I think probably in 1992 I wasn't thinking that far ahead, so I can't say that I didn't, but I can't say that I did either.
Okay, well, let's talk about the OCUFA award you received last fall. This was, I believe, in October?
Yes.
If nothing else, it speaks volumes about the high regard you're held, not only by the students, but by your peers. And that's, I suspect, a bit of a humbling experience for you.
Very humbling for me. I never expected that. It's one thing to be nominated. It's another to actually have been selected. And I actually felt it was just an achievement to be nominated. It was a complete surprise that I was actually selected.
It reflects your approach to teaching. How is what you do any different from what others do? Is there anything you could pinpoint to say, well, okay, this I know I do differently?
Well, I think probably teaching largely reflects the person. So I think probably for every teacher out there, there's probably a personalized approach to it. For myself, I really do try and keep things as simple as possible. I'm trying to catch all of the learners. There are those who learn very quickly. There are those who don't learn as quickly. And it's important that they all get the message before they leave the class. And in a university environment, there's a certain degree of trepidation, sometimes unnecessary intimidation from the student standpoint. They're coming into a university environment. They have someone who has a PhD in front of them. And I think there's a natural vulnerability. And that's hard to get through, particularly in a first-year class. Students have just left high school, and this environment is very different. The reason I bring that up is because if they don't understand, they often leave class and they don't ask for clarification or, can you teach me it again, and things like that. And I mean, once you leave the classroom, there is opportunities to get that information again from the professor through office hours, but quite often they don't take up that invitation to do so. So now you're 14 weeks later and you're writing a final exam, and if you didn't learn it back in September, October, November, then becomes much more difficult in writing your exam. So being able to capture each student and making sure that the information is presented clearly to the point where everyone understands, that's the challenge, but it's a fun challenge.
You talk about, especially with the first year, and this is so very true, when you come from high school, you could, for example, have a great score when you leave high school, but you get into this new environment known as university, and it's a totally new ball game for you. And not always, but occasionally there will be a case where the student who does really well in high school doesn't necessarily transfer as well to university and will struggle. And that, I suspect, is where you come in, because I would imagine you would sense that and perhaps do something about that. Is that your purview, to sense this person may be struggling?
Yeah, it's a responsibility. It's probably a little easier to flag those students in a very small class, but in Ontario University today, there's not too much opportunity for small classroom interaction. I teach a first-year health science class, and there's over 400 students in there. So at times, it's difficult to identify those students who are having challenges. And you're correct. High school averages are, to a significant degree, not predictive at all of what your performance in university is going to be. And I've seen as many A-plus students at Brock University, and I think I probably speak for across Ontario or Canada for that matter, that they were an A-plus in high school and they were an A-plus in elementary school, and then they come to university and it's not just the next step, it's a huge leap. And as soon as they get that first evaluation back and it's not an A, self-doubt enters in and they're going, I always get an A, and now they're not. And now that can breed more uncertainty, less confidence, and they can end up struggling. So it's not uncommon, but at the same time, it's the responsibility of the student and the responsibility of the professor to nurture that challenge that they're actually having, to bring out the best in them and get them back to a point where they're feeling really good about themselves.
Yeah, I've talked about that aspect of the symmetry between a professor and a student. It doesn't always happen, but when it does, it really is magical. When you see a student and a professor, for example, working together on a project. So it's up to you. It's your responsibility to keep an eye on things and see who's doing better than others and who needs a little bit more work. But it's so very important to that student to seek you out beyond the classroom or beyond the lecture hall and say, I didn't quite get that.
Absolutely. And the university teaching environment is very different than that of elementary and high school, because it's much more conversational learning, in the sense that we are covering content, but the professor will also quite often bring his or her own research into the classroom, and it's very current and it's cutting edge, and it often comes down to what do you think. And so instead of actually just constantly providing content information for students to write down, we're looking for their inputs, we're looking for their insights, we're looking for them to critically think, critically reflect. We're looking for their opinions. We're looking for them to challenge what I'm saying. And that's good. I think that is a healthy university classroom. And I think what that also does is it gives the student a sense of what I'm thinking and what I'm saying really matters. And that's a good thing. And that they're just not writing down everything the professor says and saying, okay, this is what university classroom learning is all about. It's about grabbing that information, questioning that information, everyone getting involved in the conversation, and then trying to get to some final summation of what we actually found. And sometimes there is no summation, right? Sometimes there's more learning outside of the classroom. So once you're leaving the lecture room, you're talking to students in the hallway, or they come to your office, or things like that. So I was asked recently about my teaching in the classroom. I made a reference that probably there's more learning that goes on outside of the classroom than there actually is that takes place in the classroom.
Well, part of university life is to generate discussion and, as you say, form opinions and challenge the professor, as you say. And I wonder if maybe that's part of the problem that some may have when they make that transition from high school to university, because you're challenging them to challenge you back, and they may not always be prepared for that. You're in a different situation now where you're presenting the information, but it's up to them to develop that critical thought and those processes and say, well, let's look at it from this point of view, for example, and challenge you on that. That may be new to them.
I think a lot of it is very new. And I think probably you also need to recognize is that they're coming from an environment that when they go to school, their perception of a teacher is largely the person that duels out content that I'm responsible for at some point down the road, whether it's a test or exam, to provide evidence that I'm actually understanding that content. But the university is different. We're not qualified teachers in the sense that we are required to go to teachers' college to be a university professor. We are required to have a PhD, but I never consider myself a teacher per se. I consider myself to be first and foremost trained as a researcher, and I also have just teaching responsibilities. And I think that is very different. When students come into university, although we have a teaching obligation, we spend as much or even more time doing research. And I think that's a real difference between public education and then when you go to university is that when we're coming into the classroom, we have a responsibility to teach. But one of the great outcomes from teaching and where you're challenging the students and you're asking for their opinions and for them to challenge you back, it often provides an opportunity to look at my own research very differently. And a great conversation with a group of students can often provoke more research questions for myself and for my students down the road. So it's a great experience.
As a researcher, you can't work in a vacuum. So if you get those other suggestions, opinions from other parts of the university, students and faculty, that can only help you.
Oh, absolutely. And you're getting those ideas all the time, whether it's from students or colleagues down the road or research colleagues from around the world.
I couldn't help but ask. You've got 5 professional degrees now, and 2 of them you earned at Brock, by the way. You're presently working on your MBA at the Goodman School of Business. I can't imagine, with research, your lectures, learning about business at the Goodman School of Business, and having a family life, how you manage to fit it all into your day. Do you have more than 24 hours in a day that we don't know about?
No. Well, first of all, I'd say I'm pecking away. It's a great example of myself because I'm a slow learner, and working on my MBA it's a slow process. But I started doing the MBA because I wanted to learn, just for the love of learning. I enjoy it, and the faculty over there are tremendous, and I work it into my schedule when I can. But what allows me to do what I do, if it does appear to be a lot, is I have a wonderful wife. She handles a lot. She takes on a lot of the responsibility, and I have 3 sons, and they're all at Brock University, and they're doing their part too. So at times it seems like a lot, or it may actually sound like a lot, but they're all doing their part too. So I mean, I'm in a nice environment where I largely do what I want to do, and I'm enjoying the ride.
How long will it realistically take you to earn your MBA?
I think it'll probably take me 5-6 years.
Okay. We talked about this before we actually started the interview, being on the other side of the podium, as you are, when you're studying at the Goodman School of Business. That's a different experience. It's a different perspective for you. It's good for you to have that because you see what's going on from the student's vantage point. I'm curious, though, in addition to that, are any of the students that you have in your lectures also alongside you at the Goodman School of Business?
It did happen. It happened last year. We have a lot of great students that graduate from the Department of Health Sciences, and a good handful of them have actually stayed at Brock University and have decided to do their MBA. And it's a nice combination, business and health, and there's tremendous opportunity out in the workforce for those who have been educated in business and health. And so last year, I actually had the opportunity of taking a class with 2 of my former students, and it's great. It's actually kind of humbling because you're really realize how good they are, which I actually already knew, and then I realized how bad I am. So they're great to work with.
And then when you're interacting with them as a student.
Yeah.
That's entirely different.
I'm no longer Dr. Fod, I'm just Brent.
Exactly. Yeah, you're Brent.
Yeah.
So does that change the dynamic at all?
I think probably it did initially because they kept calling me Dr. Fod, and I just told them, guys, just call me Brent. And it was was a lot of fun. I actually enjoy being in the seat, not behind the podium. I think it's probably great because I think you can actually become a better teacher in the classroom if you actually spend some time as a student in the university environment. And I had never done that before, right, until I started my MBA. So it's made me think of how I can probably do a better job when I'm actually teaching in my classroom. Overall, I'm learning about business, but at the same time, I'm learning how to be a better professor, a better instructor, and I enjoy it.
You're a perpetual student is what you are.
Yeah. I wouldn't say that I'm a natural learner, though. Learning doesn't come easy to myself. I was identified very young in my life in elementary school with severe learning disability in comprehension. So I spent most of my formal education in special ed. But I was fortunate to have parents that believed in me. And I come from a farming community. I have two brothers, two sisters, and they were all very excellent at school and all went on to get university degrees. And my mother and father, they just felt that even though I struggled in school, that I would just follow suit. And I did. And I ended up actually at Brock University to do my bachelor's degree. And Brock allowed me an environment in which to excel more so than I actually did in elementary and high school. And once my confidence went up, I could actually do this, although I still struggle to this day, then I wanted to learn more.
It's interesting that you were, as you say, a slow learner and you had difficulty learning in the early days. For some people, if they were in that situation, they would just throw their hands up in the air and say, to heck with this, I'm just going to go out and get a job. But you didn't. You stuck at it. And look at you. I mean, 5 degrees.
Yeah. I mean, if I wasn't a professor, I'd probably be a farmer. And there's nothing wrong with that. Although my mother and father, they're still farming to this day. They're in their mid-70s. But they wanted us to farm by coming home on weekends if we wanted to farm. But they didn't want it to be our career. They felt that there was other opportunities out there for their 5 children that they should entertain. And education does that. It allows you to entertain options, right? And when you're have a high school diploma and you think of very few career opportunities. But once you're exposed to more education, you hear about new and more types of careers out there. And you also put yourself in a position to be eligible for those careers out there. So they were adamant that I go to university. And they were right. Once I got there, I learned about all the possible options that I could grasp at.
They must realize encouraging you and the rest of the family to go to university, not to stay on the farm, that their time on the farm is limited. So the family farm, what happens to the family farm then?
Well, they're still operating the family farm. Mom and Dad, they were dairy farmers. We had a dairy operation for over 40 years, and they retired from dairy farming. It would be about 12 years ago now, but they couldn't really, when they got rid of the dairy herd, they were only without the dairy herd for about 2 months, and they went out and bought some Black Angus beef cattle. So for the last 12 years, they've been beef farming, and they have a herd of about 80 Black Angus beef. They still crop. They still do cash cropping. I mean, that's their lives, and that's what makes them happy and makes their kids happy that they're doing what they want to do. And it's a nice option that we can return to the farm whenever we want and get that farming out of us again by working with Mom and Dad on the farm. But they're very happy that their 5 children went to university and are doing other things now.
We haven't even talked about the research. Will you come back and talk some research with us?
Sure, be happy to.
Brent, thank you very much.
No problem.
That was Brock University Professor of Epidemiology and Chair of the Department of Health Sciences, Dr. Brent Fott. Incidentally, Dr. Fott has agreed to revisit us on Inquisitive Minds next week to discuss some of the amazing research he has been involved in. Brent received an award from the OCUFA recently, recognizing his work with students at Brock. And later on in the hour, we'll hear from the OCUFA about how you can send your praise for university professor who made a difference in your life. It's a bit of an awards program on Inquisitive Minds this week, since we're deep into awards season on television, of course. Brock Associate Professor of English Language and Literature, Adam Dickinson, was a finalist in the category for English Language Poetry at the Governor General Literary Awards, administered by the Canada Council for the Arts and held in Ottawa at the end of November. Professor Dickinson's third book of poetry, published by House of Anansi Press last year, is entitled The Polymers, wherein Dickinson deftly combines science and poetry. Professor Dickinson joined us in our CFBU-FM studios recently to talk about his book, The Literary Awards, and how he came to love poetry. I first asked about the importance of being shortlisted for the Governor General's Literary Awards.
Well, it's a huge honor. It's one of the top literary prizes in the country. In fact, it's the oldest literary prize in the country. The Giller, the Griffin Poetry Prize, these others have come along more recently. So it's a huge honor for me, absolutely.
You were shortlisted, but you didn't win.
That's right. That's right.
What was the disappointment factor for you?
Well, I suppose it's true there was a little bit of disappointment, but partly because you realize, well, you know, you've come so close, a 1 in 5 chance. So I suppose I was slightly disappointed there. But then I quickly recovered and realized how fortunate I was to have been shortlisted in the first place. And at the end of the day, when I think about the Governor General's Literary Awards or other literary prizes, of course I pay attention to them, I'm actually hard-pressed to say who's won any given year. I often remember the shortlist. I remember people who are nominated, but I often don't remember who actually won. So being nominated, being shortlisted for the award is kind of like winning it.
So being shortlisted, what does that do for your career and ultimately the sale of your books, do you think?
Well, it does a lot of things for my career. It gives me attention, which is what writers are interested in, having an audience, having a wider audience. So my book will get more attention. I've already received some reviews in the United States. I've been invited to an international literary festival in Rotterdam this summer. So, I mean, I don't know necessarily if the Governor General's Award is the reason for these things, but it can't hurt. I think that it's definitely increased my profile as a poet, as a writer.
Now, this is your third book.
That's right.
Being the third book, was it any easier to get published?
Well, I suppose after having published two books, I had a little more of a profile. Certainly, I think it's hard to publish your first book, partly because you don't have a profile at that point or you have a limited one. So I suppose it was slightly easier in that respect. I was fortunate that my two previous books were also nominated for awards, not a national award like this one, but my second book was nominated for the Trillium Book Award for Poetry, which is an Ontario prize, which is significant. I was very happy to receive that nomination as well. I suppose I had a little bit more of a profile coming into it with this book. I know more and more people. I know more and more editors because I've been involved in writing for more and more years. So I suppose that doesn't hurt either. But in terms of actually publishing the book, that's one thing to find a press. And I was really happy that House of Anansi accepted the manuscript. But actually writing the book and working on the book and finishing the book, this was definitely the hardest of the three, for sure. I think just maybe it was the nature of the project, the nature of my ambition with the book. It was challenging. It took a long time.
Where did your love of poetry come from in the first place?
I've always been interested in writing. I remember as a child being interested in writing, even before I could necessarily read. I remember writing or manufacturing stories, at least making stories in the way that I thought they should look. I guess in high school, I really started writing poetry. And yeah, I was fortunate in high school that I had some mentors who were very encouraging, including the author Waylon Drew, who died a few years ago. But nonetheless, he was very important to me. In high school, he was an example of a professional writer, someone who had some stature and he was able to give me some advice. In some ways, it's hard to answer the question because it's just kind of always been there for me.
So early influences in your career, could you pin down anyone in particular beyond who you've already mentioned there?
Well, you mean in terms of Canadian writers, or do you mean in terms of historical writers, for example, who influenced my work?
Let's talk about historical writers.
Well, I mean, the very first poet I fell in love with was Dylan Thomas in high school. I actually recall taking one of his books out of the library, and I missed the bus home one day, so I had to walk, which is about an hour for me where I lived. And I read his book, his collected poems, the whole way home. I didn't understand anything, but I was just amazed that someone could do this with language, and I wanted to try it myself.
And as far as Canadians?
Oh, Canadians, Leonard Cohen for sure, when I was growing up, Margaret Atwood's poetry. Subsequently, all kinds of contemporary Canadian writers are very important to me. Aaron Murray, Lisa Robertson, Ken Babstock, people like this, Matt Tierney and Andy Weaver. I'm also more and more involved in a kind of community of contemporary writers too, and lots of Canadian poets. There's just fantastic things happening in Canada with poetry. Karen Soley, another writer as well.
So although you're striking out on your own as a writer, how much do those early influences imbue your own writing? Or is it a case of they help you to find your own path?
Well, they were models. Now that I teach creative writing as well, I often reflect on what it was like for me to be a young writer, because you start writing and you don't necessarily, you have a sort of limited sense of the tradition. And so certainly the writers that you encounter when you're a young writer tend to sort of define your universe. But when you're older, you realize how limited that is at the time. And so it's interesting for me to reflect as I teach writing. And when I think about the experiences of the students who come into my class, yeah, I mean, the early writers that I encountered, like Leonard Cohen, for example, were really important for me in terms of defining what I thought poetry was and what I thought poetry could do. But, you know, that changes over time. It always changes. It's still changing for me.
It's just like any language and any form of writing. It evolves over time and with the people who are doing the writing.
That's right.
Now, the new book is called The Polymers.
That's right.
You brought the book in and you offered to read a passage from it. Mm-hmm. So before we talk about the book, if you'd like to give us a passage from the book, and then we'll go from there.
Okay. I suppose I should mention a little bit about the book, just so this passage in part makes some sense. The book is essentially a kind of imaginary science project that attempts to read the language of plastics, the scientific language of plastics, their structure, their composition, into analogous cultural circumstances, linguistic circumstances, and social circumstances. So I'm looking at how polymers behave culturally, how we might think of, extend our idea of plastic, in a sense, from, which is what polymers are, although they're more than that. Polymers are synthetic and biological, if you like. So plastic is the primary example of synthetic polymers. But there are natural polymers like your hair and skin, for example. Those are composed of polymers. So I was interested in this overlap, of course, between the biological and the synthetic, but also interested in playing on metaphors of plastic and plasticity and how it might change our relationship to plastic were we to think of the ways in which culturally and socially we express polymeric formations. What does that do to how we think about our relationship to plastic? That's sort of one of the things that I explore. The poem that I'll read for you is an example of a linguistic polymer, which is to say polymers are, they're giant molecules composed of small repeating units. So this idea of repetition or iteration is very important to polymers. And so I identified in language, for example, some rhetorical formations that behave like polymers. And one of them is polysyndeton, which is a rhetorical form. You see it often in the Bible and other texts like this, which make use of repeated and formations. So and this and that and this and such, etc., etc. The repetition of conjunctions in close succession for rhetorical effect. This struck me as an example of a kind of polymer in language. So polymers are there, not only in the plastics that surround us, but also in the ways in which we express ourselves, in the rhetoric and arguments we might use, for example, to define a faith. So in this case, the poem makes use of polysyndeton. It's called Obsessive Compulsive. Make a roof for the people, and the people walk down the street with resin for a roof, and the roof has magnesium in it and sulfur. And the people walk down the street with resin in their hair, and resins are always falling from the sky to the ground, and the birds make a people in the sky, a people of the resin. And the resin is composed of sky, and it composes the sky, and the people walking down the street are the strings of resins, and covering their hair with their arms, with newspapers, with umbrellas. The people are the birds of resins, throwing their landings in the air like people for whom landings are uncommon. Like people committed to the expulsion of landings, the resins coming down upon them like people driven out of countries discovered by resins, or that have discovered resins in veins in the countertops of suburbs, and people walk down the street with resins for hair, with countries committed to color, with the bonds between them, the birds circling, and people walking down the street with hunched shoulders so as not to look up and call the resins by name, call the resins in the name of the birds, the people circling and loosening.
That's from The Polymers by Adam Dickinson, who was our guest in the studio on Inquisitive Minds. With The Polymers, you combine science and poetry, and that's fascinating what you read. Where did your fascination or interest in science come from?
I suspect it came from my childhood. My father was trained as a botanist and a biologist. He was a science teacher. He's retired now. He was a science teacher at a high school. But he was always involved in various scientific projects, research projects, especially when I was younger. And one of the projects was was he participated in the mapping of the monarch butterfly migrations when this was being discovered. Where, you know, where do the monarchs go? You know, this great insect migration. It was unsure where these insects went. Of course, we now know it was to a very specific mountaintop in Mexico. So he was a part of this. And so I have these idyllic childhood memories, actually, of running with nets and catching butterflies, and we would tag them. And I remember being involved in these scientific experiments very early on. And I must say, I mean, you know, you asked me about writing before. I was struggling with trying to identify the origins of my affections for writing. I would say the same thing about science. It's always been there for me. I've always been interested in it. When I was in grade 9, I think I went to the Canada-wide Science Fair with a project. So it's always been something very important to me. And poetry and science, it seems to me, have a great deal in common. They're both sort of performing experiments at the limits of their disciplines, whether it be questions of physical or biological space or conceptual space when it comes to language and meaning. They're both engaged in the imaginative limits of their disciplines. And they're both engaged in what I think of as pattern recognition, too. Metaphorical thinking is about pattern recognition. You know, who would think that these two things could go together, for example, plastics and poetry? Or take any kind of metaphorical juxtaposition. I think that science does this, too. You draw from unexpected contexts of understanding in order to solve problems that are difficult. What happens if we apply this formula or this understanding of a particular structure or solution to a proof to this other distant, disparate idea? Perhaps there's something to be learned by doing that, right? So it's kind of pattern recognition, kind of metaphorical juxtaposition, I think, that poetry and science share in this kind of activity.
Was there a fear, though, the poetry could become, for some perhaps, maybe a bit too technical because of the science aspect? Or is that simply one of the challenges that you face as a writer to make it clear what you're trying to convey?
That's a good question. I thought about that a great deal. I think that there's actually a great deal of texture and wealth to the language of science. I think that the terms are really rich and interesting. I love the word polymers, for example, and the various terminologies surrounding the science of plastics and the science of polymers. I think this is a resource to draw upon for poetry, for example. They are technical words, but they're also very interesting and beautiful words. But I did think about this question about, you know, to what degree the book would be engaged technically with what it does. You know, it remains for me an art project. It is a poetry project. So the challenge was to be true to the science. I mean, the book is composed really of 7 sections, but it's composed of the 6 main, the most common plastic resins. It's divided up into those sections, and each of the sections is organized according to the atomic structure of the various plastic resins. So section 1 is polyester. Sections 2 and 4 are polyethylene, high density and low density. Section 3 is polyvinyl chloride. Section 5 is polypropylene. Section 6 is polystyrene. And section 7 is other. Now, all of these resins are very familiar to you. If you turn over a plastic cup or any kind of plastic product, you'll see the little triangular recycle sign. And inside that sign is a number. And that indicates what resin the product you're holding is made of. So these are all around us, these plastics. On the one hand, I mean, I understand that plastics is a potentially kind of foreign and unusual way to approach poetry. But on the other hand, these things are everywhere. And they're very common and readily, I think, identifiable. So I'm playing with the foreignness of the science, I suppose, of plastics on the one hand, but also its utter ubiquity. It surrounds us. It's utterly familiar to us as well. So those sorts of tensions, I think, work through the book and I think help mitigate in some ways some of the distance that people might ostensibly think when they think, well, poetry and plastics, how can you bring these things together?
I'm tempted to ask if you're a frustrated scientist finding releasing your poetry.
Frustrated scientist? No. I mean, I feel fortunate and excited to be able to study science and poetry together. I think it's actually important for artists to do this. And of course, I would never be prescriptive. I wouldn't say that all artists should do this. But for me, I think it's important because science has become, in so many ways, the arbiter of what is true and false in our culture. Science has a great deal of power culturally. And I think that it's incumbent upon poets and artists to think about this, not as a rejection of science, but as an engagement with it, as an engagement with these questions of truth and falsity, with these questions of experimentation and a hypothesis. Science has so much power in our culture. I think poets, artists need to play with it and engage with it. And so that's what I'm doing.
Now, you've written about environmental ethics outside from your poetry. What specifically were you looking at?
Well, I work in an emerging discipline called ecopoetics, ecocriticism, I suppose, more generally. It's developed in the past 20 years or so. There are some proto-ecocritical texts that come from before that time period, but it's really an attempt to sort of reckon with the environment in literature. The environment has often been sort of relegated to a kind of minor status of importance, the setting of the text, for example, the mood. it was a stormy night. You know, these sorts of things. But what are we doing? What kinds of assumptions are we making about the environment? How can we talk about environmental ethics through literary texts? On the other hand, if you think about sort of the great intellectual traditions or developments of the 20th century, you've got Freud, you've got Marx, you've got scholars engaging with Marxism, engaging with psychoanalysis. There hasn't been a lot of engagement with, say, Darwin, for example. Although that's happening. It's coming now. And that's part of eco-criticism. It's part of science thinking about evolution and biology and literature and their relationship. Science studies as well. So my work looks specifically, I suppose, at the intersection between science that imagines itself as poetry and poetry that imagines itself as science, as I call it. I'm interested in sort of emerging and experimental traditions in biology as well, biosemiotics in particular. So the way in which we might understand life processes as not simply being governed by genetics or various automatic chemical structures or mechanisms, but also through sign systems and processes. So the ways in which the environment constitutes a sort of field or realm of signification to plants and organisms. You know, what matters for a tick, for example, is a much smaller universe of signification, but nonetheless is very powerful. Butyric acid, which is the smell of mammalian sweat, hair, blood temperature of 37 degrees Celsius. These things are signs. They're a kind of language that speaks to the tick. For example, you can construct and think about semiotic universes in a sense, and suddenly you think of some biological systems then become relevant or related to thinking about linguistic systems and the ways in which our world is composed of signs and messages. The hormonal system of the body, for example, is a system of messages. So I'm really interested in exploring these overlaps between science and writing.
How prominent is poetics in the school curriculum today? Is it prominent enough? I would think that they would go hand in hand with creative writing, but we hear more about creative writing than anything else.
Yeah, I think poetry is a big part of creative writing. It's hard for me to answer in some ways because I don't exactly know what goes on in the high schools. When I speak to sometimes high school teachers or even some of my colleagues at the university, I get the sense sometimes that people are nervous about teaching poetry, find it a little bit frightening, which, you know, I understand to some degree. So I wonder if sometimes the teaching of poetry suffers a little bit because of that. They feel less comfortable teaching it in high school in particular. You know, but having said that, there's a tremendous appetite for and interest among students in creative writing and poetry in particular, I would say. We have a huge number of people at Brock, for example, involved in the Creative Writers Club, and they publish an annual anthology, which includes some fiction, but it mostly includes poetry. The students are very interested in poetry. I don't see any shortage at all of interest culturally, that which is fascinating to me. Perhaps it is not being taught as much, but I don't think that that has translated necessarily into a diminution in interest in poetry.
So when they get to the university level and you're interacting with these students, they've been exposed in some way to poetry. It's not totally foreign to them. They know what they're up against.
Right. I would say that their exposure in most cases, not all cases, but in most cases is relatively limited. But that's fine. I accept that, right? That's part of my job at the university is to expose them then to the wider tradition and to wider possibilities when it comes to thinking about poetry. But yeah, I feel that they have had some training. But a lot of them seek it out on their own too and pursue it, which I'm delighted and intrigued by as well. And those are often the students most ambitious and most game when it comes to running with some of the things that I give them when they arrive.
Talking about your book again, just for a couple of moments here, how long did it take you from start to finish to put the book together?
Well, that's a hard question to answer. I started writing the book right when I came to Brock, but I was really dealing with a lot of other things too. I was publishing other articles and doing other scholarly projects. So this book kind of went on the back burner for a little bit, and then I revived it. It's hard to say how long it took. It very much was a research project. I conducted research. You know, I was telling you before about these examples of accretion or accumulation or iteration or repetition. These are what polymers are as structures, molecular structures. So I did research on their cultural analogs. So I did research on anxieties, memes, archetypes, hoaxes, fashions, trends, anything sort of built on this idea of repetition or accretion, including, for example, I spent a day, more than one day, but one memorable day in particular, standing in line at the Maid of the Mist in Niagara Falls with the intention of never actually getting on the Maid of the Mist, just circulating back through the lineup, because that's what polymers are. They're lineups, they're chains. And so I wanted to, this was part of my research, I wanted to perform an actual experiment on a lineup and record and stand, listen to what people were saying. I initially planned to record it with a tape recorder, but I couldn't do that. It was way too conspicuous. So I had to write things down in my notebook, which I suppose was also strange enough, but somehow less intimidating, I think, to the other people in the lineup. The people at the Maid of the Mist were very kind. They allowed me to go down, put on the blue rain slicker, but just not get on the boat, just sort of circulate back up to the top and come down the lineup. They were curious about what I was doing, but by the end of the day, they started to regale me with their own stories about the lineup, strange things that had happened, strange people who had been in the lineup. This was all part of the research. I mean, what I I discovered, I suppose, in a very interesting way, what people talk about in lineups is quite often the lineup. Sort of self-referential construction to this chain. That's an example, I suppose, of some of the more entertaining or unusual research that I did. A lot of it was reading, especially when it came to learning about polymers and the science of plastics. I also worked with a chemist because some of the molecules, section 7 of the book, is actually made up of imaginary plastics. I wanted to see if I could determine the repeating units at the heart of some culturally influential texts. So what is that polymer at the center of, say, Darwin's The Origin of Species, right? Which is a text that has been repeated culturally in all kinds of ways, positively and negatively. People respond to it in different ways. I performed some experiments on a number of texts. That was one that was successful. And there was one other that was successful as well, the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. So I had to find the repeat units in these texts. So I exposed them to all kinds of various sorting programs, finding the word lengths, finding the most common repeated words in the text, all kinds of things, determining grammatical structures. So I was looking for these repeating units in an attempt then to find the molecular formula at the heart of these texts to determine their polymeric repeating units, their MERS, if you like, the polymers. That took a lot of time, but you'll see in the book, I actually invented some plastics that are functional. They could work. They're made up, but they're accurate. Like, they function within the laws of chemistry. And this was important to me. So I worked with a chemist to make sure that what I was doing was possible. And a chemist at Brock, a PhD student, Mark Frampton, was very helpful in helping me draw a number of the diagrams that I used in here as well. So I needed some specialized software to make some of these chemical diagrams.
So while others will do research and publish a paper, your research, the tangible result, was publishing a book of poetry.
Yeah, that was certainly part of it. I mean, I have written as well. I've written reflective essays on this particular book. And my next book as well has involved what you might think of as more sort of typical academic essays, but they accompany the creative project. I really see my creative work and my academic scholarship as really tightly interconnected. So yes, absolutely. This book is an expression of a research project. Absolutely. Maybe an unconventional one, but it is.
I wanted to ask a historical question here that I was curious about it because I read about this not too long ago. I think back 50 years to the inauguration of JFK, and Robert Frost recited a poem of the ceremony. Mm-hmm. It was a bit of a big deal at the time, albeit it was a different poem than the one that he had actually written for the occasion. We don't give that kind of prominence to poetry today in mainstream media, I find, and I wonder why that is.
It's true. I mean, we now have a poet laureate in Canada. We haven't had a poet laureate before. I guess the poet laureate's been around for, I think, 10 years. So that's new. You're right. I mean, Robert Frost read JFK's inauguration. Maya Angelou, I think, read Bill Clinton's inauguration. Poetry does seem to occupy less of the public attention. Having said that, I mean, there's advantages and disadvantages to that. It's true. I would like poetry to have a higher profile. On the other hand, what poetry is doing is difficult, and it always will be difficult. Poetry lives at the limits of language and the limits of expression, the limits of what it is possible to say and think. And I think for this reason, it's always challenging. It's difficult. It's not an easy space to go into. But I think it's a very, very rewarding space, and I think that the people who enter into it would agree. Poetry will never die. People will always be interested in it because people will always be interested in the limits of language and culture. Those limits will always exist. I lament, I suppose, the fact that it doesn't occupy a greater place in our discourse, our general cultural discourse, but that might say a little bit more about the level of that particular discourse. However, I do think there's an advantage to being on the margins, if you like. It allows poets to get away with a lot of things, to say things and be provocative and to be controversial in ways that are actually quite difficult the more money and capital is involved in your artistic enterprise. I was just reading an essay the other day about the art world and the way in which money has influence to such a huge degree who gets celebrated and supported. And I think that, you know, even in the fiction world, you see that a lot more. It matters to these presses, especially nowadays, whose book is going to be popular, who's going to sell the most books. But we all know, of course, that great books aren't necessarily bestsellers, right? And we learn this later on. It takes a long time for these things to reveal themselves. And so I think poetry is insulated a little bit from this because it doesn't make the same kind of money for people. So it's a double-edged sword. It's good on the one hand. I think it leads to a very healthy art form. But on the other hand, of course, I would like more people, all writers, write for an audience, and they would like that audience to be as large as possible.
The new book is called The Polymers, and it's from House of Anansi Press. And Adam Dickinson, professor at Brock University, the author, and our guest on the program. Thank you. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
And that was Brock, Associate Professor of English Language and Literature Adam Dickinson, joining us in the studio recently. As mentioned earlier in the hour, the OCUFA, the Ontario Confederation of University Faculty Associations, wants to hear from you about a university professor who has impacted your life or your education. They've launched a video contest calling on students to create videos about how a professor's research inspired them or helped them to succeed. You can then post the video to the contest's Facebook page and encourage friends to vote for your video. Called We Teach Ontario, the contest is designed to highlight how together teaching and research are the heart of our province's universities. I talked by phone recently with OCUFA Communications Manager Graham Stewart about the contest, and we began by talking about the OCUFA in the first place.
Well, the OCUFA, or the Ontario Confederation of University Faculty Associations, which is the world's longest title, represents university faculty and academic librarians in Ontario. So we represent 17,000 full and part-time professors and librarians at 27 faculty associations across the province.
Now, is this basically a governing body of some sort for the university faculty?
Not a governing body. We're a representative body. So what we do is work at the provincial level to improve the quality of higher education in Ontario and also to work on the interests and issues that are important to our members.
So how would you work with the members and the university bodies? Are you sort of like a liaison, as it were?
Well, slightly, yeah. I mean, we are a liaison with the provincial government, certainly, and the other provincial bodies that exist, such as the Council of Ontario Universities or the student groups that exist in the province, so the Canadian Federation of Students and the Ontario Undergraduate Student Alliance. But our members are the individual faculty associations, so they're sort of responsible for representing the members on their particular campus, and they're members of us, so the interests kind of flow up to the provincial level through our members that way.
Before we get to the contest, the OCUFA, do you support universities with their research in any way other than offering your own support directly?
No, we don't sort of get involved in that. I mean, what we do is we advocate to the provincial government for the need, for example, for better research funding, and particularly better research funding for basic research, basic or curiosity-driven research. So that's where we kind of get involved in the research enterprise. I mean, we don't really do any administrative functions there, or we don't disperse any funding or anything like that. But we do sort of work to make sure that quality research is well supported, both by the institutions and by the provincial government.
Now we're on the subject of how important research is. It may seem like an obvious question on my part, but I'm asking this for a reason. How important is the research being done in the university setting today?
Well, I mean, from our perspective, and CUFA believes this very strongly, is that, you know, research in partnership with teaching are really at the heart of our universities. They're sort of the core of what we understand a university to be. So together, those two things are what, you know, allows universities to train and educate the next generation of, you know, leaders, innovators, thinkers, to create new knowledge and innovation that both drive our economy forward, but also improve the quality of life of people living in the province and probably around the world as well. And, you know, it's really vital to what we want to accomplish in Ontario as a society. Research really underpins a lot of the advancements that we want to make and the directions we want to go.
Okay, so let's talk about the video contest.
Yeah.
What's the premise behind the whole idea here?
Well, it's part of our We Teach Ontario campaign, which we launched last year. And this is sort of the latest iteration of it. And the whole idea of the campaign is to sort of highlight this partnership between teaching and research and sort of explain the ways and really the exceptional things that can happen when you keep research and teaching connected. So on the website at weteachontario.ca, we've got videos of professors who are connecting research and teaching in really exciting ways. And the idea behind the contest is really to give students an opportunity to tell that story, to say why research and teaching has been important to their education, and to kind of highlight professors that have inspired them through that kind of bringing research into the classroom and connecting their teaching with their research in powerful ways.
So would it only be like an individual professor, or, for example, if you were majoring in something and it was that
that really inspired you to go on with your studies, would that qualify?
Yeah, we've left it fairly open to the students. I mean, we're just kind of interested in hearing their voices on this issue. And so, yeah, it could be an individual prof that did this in a really special way. It could be an entire discipline. It could be an entire, you know, university or faculty within that university that a student has found inspiring. So we're just asking for them to kind of tell us why in the most creative way that they can come up with.
I was going to ask about how creative they have to be. And have you seen any samples already that give you some inspiration that, boy, there's a lot of creative individuals out there?
Yeah, well, we've had some entries come in already, and they've been very interested. They're actually posted up on our Facebook site, facebook.com/WeTeachOntario, which is where the contest is running. And yeah, I mean, it's been people bringing in photos and little snippets of their research and things like that, that help tell that story. And as we say, I mean, we're open to just about anything that kind of tells this story in an interesting way. So it could be as simple as somebody with their phone just taking a video saying, like, oh, here's the story, or graphics, animation, whatever people want to do. We're really excited to see what they come up with.
So it's really up to the students to see how creative they want to get as far as this is concerned and how professional they want to make it appear.
Yeah, we don't expect glossy, high production values. I mean, some people may come up with that, and that's fabulous, but the technical side of it is less interesting than the story that they're telling us about what's inspired them and what's important to them and their education.
It's interesting that in this day and age, it's so easy to launch a competition such as this, a video competition, because there was a time when you needed a lot of equipment to be able to do something like this or know someone who had access to that equipment. Now, pretty much everyone, and certainly in the student body, will have a smartphone that can record video.
And that's one of the things that kind of excited us about doing this kind of contest is, you know, there's so many different technological tools that can do it and so many different sites that support it. So YouTube, Vine, Vimeo, whatever. I mean, all of these outlets are Instagram as well. Those are the things that we're looking to for people to bring their stories in. So, yeah, the infrastructure to support something like this has come so far and has been so popularized that really is possible to do something on a large scale.
Are there any length restrictions as far as how long the video can be?
No, there's no restrictions on length, and there's no sort of minimum length either. So if 20 seconds long, then sure, send it in. And if it's hour long, great. Yeah, we'll take a look at everything.
You might be sorry you said that.
Yes, well, you never know. We may get 100-hour-long entries, and that's my February, just watching those, but we'll see.
So what are the prizes that are going to be awarded here?
Well, we have prizes. The runners-up, there are iPads available for them, and then the grand prize, the winner will get an iPhone 5S, which is pretty cool. But what's even cooler, I think, is the winner will be brought to Toronto. We have a conference coming up at the end of February, the Future U Conference, and as part of the prize, they'll get free registration in that trip to Toronto, and their video will actually be played at the conference. So we think that's kind of a neat way to do things and to reward people for the work that they've put in.
What's the deadline period to get in on this?
February 10th. At 11:59 p.m. So literally to the 11th hour, we will be accepting entries at that point.
Okay, all right. It's funny because when you were talking about the prizes there, the thought ran through my mind, isn't the iPad a wonderful thing? Because you see that when there's a lot of competitions or prizes to be given out, the iPad is almost always in there. And it's one of those, I've got to have that sort of a thing that really gets people motivated to perhaps enter a contest.
Yeah, and it's something that it's easy to offer as a prize because it's very kind of compact and it's kind of a very appealing item and, you know, a very useful one to students. I think that there's so many apps and things that can be run off of an iPad and that are useful in someone's studies. So, yeah, we think it fits in pretty well with the spirit of the contest and kind of the interests of the people that we're looking to reach.
But we must admit that being able to get to the conference gratis, that's an even better prize.
Yeah, that's something we've never done this before, so it's kind of a fun thing to offer and to come see. It's going to be quite an interesting conference. We've got people from around the world who are coming to talk, so yeah, we're very excited to be able to offer that as a prize.
Okay, now speaking of for yourself personally, did you find inspiration in any of the professors that you had when you were in university? And if so, why?
Well, yeah, I mean, I did, and it started immediately. When I started my undergrad at Queen's University, I was originally, because you sort of have to sort of notionally say what your program's going to be and where your major is, and I was, I think, sociology and film when I went in, but, you know, I had to take some other courses, some electives, and I was in a first-year political science course taught by George Perlin, who's kind of the guy on Canadian federal politics, and on the strength of his presence in the classroom, I was like, well, forget this sociology film thing, I'm political studies all the way. So that really changed my direction and has kind of influenced every other step of education I've taken.
I've often found that that symmetry, if you will, or compatibility between a university professor and a student, it's a very special thing, and it doesn't always happen. The gelling, if you will, doesn't always happen, but when it does, it really is magical.
It is, yeah, and I think it makes such a huge difference for a student to find that professor that really speaks to them and speaks to their interest. And what we're seeing from some of the entries, and is something we want to see more of in Ontario universities generally, is that, you know, often the chance for undergraduate or even sort of junior graduate students, like master's students, to really get involved in a research project, to really connect with a professor's research and get out in the field and do some stuff, is such an enriching experience and so important to their future direction.
Okay, so give me the Facebook location again to send people to for the contest.
Sure, it's facebook.com/WeTeachOntario. And WeTeachOntario, there's no spaces in there.
And the website you said was weteachontario.ca?
That's correct, yep.
Perfect. So people have, the deadline for entries is 11:59 p.m. on February the 10th.
That's correct.
Excellent. Graham, thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you. It was great talking to you.
That was Graham Stewart, Communications Manager for the Ontario Confederation of University Faculty Associations. Their newly launched video contest for students is called We Teach Ontario, and the website, as he mentioned, weteachontario.ca. For more information and to get your entry in, you go to the Facebook page. That's it for this edition of Inquisitive Minds on CFPU-FM 103.7 in St. Catharines. My name is Mike Saunders. I hope you've enjoyed the show. You can contact me via email at any time at talk@cfpu.ca with show comments and suggestions. Until next week, always remember to have an inquisitive mind. Thank you.